The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. This week, the GDP numbers reflect two consecutive quarters of contraction. For the average American, that means recession. It feels like a recession. Not for this administration. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
I'm just saying that we're just not going to define it.
We'll turn to veteran economist Stephen Moore.
80% of Americans believe the United States economy is on the wrong track.
The president, whatever else you say about him, has not inspired confidence.
There are bottlenecks and indecision is plaguing the White House.
And the angst and frustration in the electorate that we saw in 2016 is still very much present today. We'll hear from Brett Baer on what gave us Trump in 2016.
He's going to kick the table over and do something different.
All this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24-7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well, please, at Town Hall Review. We'll begin with the economy. Inflation and high fuel prices continue to hit American families, particularly households with fixed incomes or limited incomes. Simply put, inflation hits the working and the poor the hardest. After the profligate spending from President Biden, Leader Schumer, and Speaker Pelosi that fueled this inflation, we've been watching to see if it would push the economy into recession. The simplest, most common understanding of recession has been two consecutive quarters of negative growth in the nation's GDP, our gross domestic product. As it became clear that we would see those two consecutive quarters of contraction, the administration would not concede that we are, in fact, in a recession. Here is our president.
We're not going to be in a recession, in my view. The employment rate is still one of the lowest we've had in history. It's in the 3.6 area. My hope is we go from this rapid growth to steady growth. And we'll see some coming down. But I don't think we're going to, God willing, I don't think we're going to see a recession.
We'll turn to veteran economist Stephen Moore. He joined Chris DeGaulle, my colleague on AM 990, The Answer in Philadelphia.
I hate to say it. I'm going to use the R word, a recession. What's really interesting about this debate is, look, Chris, you're a great communicator. You've been in communications your whole life. So, you know, one of the first things you learn when you're communicating, whether it's for a candidate or a campaign or something, if there's a certain word you don't want to people to use, you don't keep talking about the word, right? So the White House, in incredible incompetence, they set all their minions out on the Sunday talk show to say, oh, no, there's no recession. No, this isn't a recession. This isn't officially a recession. And so that all they've done is spark a 3 or 4 day debate about whether we're in a recession.
It's remarkable. He says economic progress is measured through increased wages and the equitable nature of the recovery. I don't even know what that means. I measure recovery by disposable income. I don't know about you, Steve-O, but I measure it by disposable income. Do I have more money to spend on other things or not? That's how I take a listen to some of this madness, and then I want your response, please.
Are we putting in place the right policies and the right strategies that will help those working Americans, middle-class families, achieve some measure of economic security and economic dignity, and be able to have upward economic mobility as well? And I think if you look at the progress that we have made over the course of the last 18 months, we have made historic strides in many areas, not the least of which has been the pace of this historic economic recovery and the return of job growth, the increase in wages, particularly for those at the bottom end, the equitable nature of this recovery. And we have a serious inflation challenge, which is hitting economies around the globe, but is hitting Americans. And that's why you have a president that is focused as acutely as he is on what we can do to actually lower prices right now. And I would say that, you know, the reduction in gas prices that you've seen over the last couple of weeks is providing some measure of breathing room, not enough, but some measure of breathing room.
Yeah, and they're tweeting out how proud they are that they're not whacking you as hard with gas prices. But two negative quarters of GDP growth is not the technical definition of recession, direct quote, he says. It's not the definition the economists have traditionally relied on. You're an economist. Is that true? That's not how you define it?
Well, first of all, let's go back to that Biden's quote. Everything was talking about, creating an economy with lots of jobs and increases in wages for the middle and lower income people. That was Donald Trump. That's what we did, not them. That's exactly what we had. We had the biggest gains in incomes for the, it was amazing. You know, for the, these policies didn't benefit the rich. They benefited everybody. But the biggest wage gains were actually for the lowest income people. Now, what's happening today? Exactly the opposite of what Ryan D. said. Who are the people, Chris, do you think they're getting crushed by inflation?
Right.
I'm sure it's not Warren Buffett. It's not, you know, Elon Musk. It's not Mark Zuckerberg. People getting crushed by inflation are the lowest income people. So this BS about some kind of equitable recovery, first of all, there is no recovery. Second of all, it ain't equitable because the people at the bottom are the ones who are getting, you know, just crushed. And the surveys show lower income people now are having to cut back on even essentials, you know, what they can buy at the grocery store because of this high inflation. So come on.
How do you, that is just a bunch of gibberish. Let's talk about what you define as recession. How do you define, they say most economists don't even agree with GDP growth, a loss for two consecutive quarters. That's the, most economists don't define it that way. Is that true or not true?
That's wrong. No, that's not. The dictionary definition of a recession, I've been in this game for 35 years, has been two straight quarters of negative growth. You know, you can look at other factors. And by the way, we'll probably get a number that is somewhat negative for the second quarter. We don't know exactly what that number is going to be. I'm going to predict it to be about maybe negative 1%. But there's a chance, you know, we never know with these numbers. Maybe it might be 0.2. We might be actually slightly positive. But here's the point. 80% of Americans today, Chris, 80% believe the United States economy is on the wrong track. So I don't care what the official definition of recession is, because, and by the way, the official definition really is two negative quarters. But when you've got 80%, that's a worse number than you had under Jimmy Carter, for goodness sake.
At the end of the day, Stephen Moore's point is the point that mattered. 80% of Americans believe that the American economy is on the wrong track. The president is struggling mightily. He says he's running in 2024. But even if he runs, it is not at all clear that he's going to be the nominee for the Democratic Party. Quote, Biden faces a mutiny. That's the title of a recent column from our next guest, Tevi Troy, known best as a presidential historian, but also long experienced in government. Join me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. The very famous 1976 Reagan versus Ford. I was with Ford on that. I was against the tide of history. And then we've got 1980 Jimmy Carter and Teddy Kennedy, which was bloody and long. And then, of course, the 1992 Pat Buchanan insurgency against George H.W. Bush. Of all of those, to what is the greatest parallel to where Biden finds himself today, Tevi Troy?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say probably 76. I mean, sorry, 80, the Carter versus Kennedy one. Inflation, difficult time, economically difficult time around the world. And someone more charismatic comes from the left challenge. We don't know who that is yet. But the really interesting thing is that in all those races you mentioned and that I put in the article, Hugh, the incumbent president never won election again after being challenged. And none of the challengers became president in that cycle.
I think the parallel to me, Tevi, is 1968, because if Biden runs, he's going to run from an incredibly divisive position and a party that does not like him. And as you say, a staff that thinks he's dithering, Mr. Magoo. You didn't say Mr. Magoo, I did. And therefore, he may not lose New Hampshire, but someone will do to him what Eugene McCarthy did to LBJ, and then the floodgates will open.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, there is that sense, as in 68, that nobody wants to go first, in part because of the history that I lay out. If you know that running will damage your own party in the upcoming presidential election, you don't want to be tagged as the guy who's disloyal. And so that's why everybody's kind of waiting to see if somebody else will jump in first. So 16.
Yeah, the Washington Post runs a pundit. All the columnists do predictions. And so this week is who's going to be the favorite for the Democratic nominee if Biden doesn't run? And my five are Gavin Newsom, one, Pete Buttigieg, two, Gina Raimondo, three, Josh Shapiro, assuming he wins and he's going to win in Pennsylvania, four, and then Ro Khanna, simply because someone's got to fly the Sanders flag. And they're all not Kamala Harris. I think that's my key point. I don't think she's kind of like Hubert Humphrey without the likelihood of getting the boss's endorsement.
Yeah, look, I don't have any inside information on this, Hugh, but I read a lot on this stuff, and the article suggests that she is quietly reaching out for fundraising help from some of the big donors. She's obviously the vice president, and she's got name recognition, and her political skills are clearly questionable, as you've well laid out on the show. But I wouldn't count her out at this point yet.
You know, it's interesting. I counted her in way too long in 2020, and maybe I'm counting her out too early in 2024, but my gosh, she never fails to disappoint. Tevi Troy, in terms of the White House staff, this is well known about the president. He's not decisive. At what point, how do they signal this? What do they do? You know, you can't really make an old man young.
Yeah, I would actually question this, that whether it's well known that Biden's not decisive. I mean, I think he has been somewhat decisive in the past. I think the issue here, and what I lay out in the journal column, is that there's this new narrative developing that current Biden 28.0, is less decisive, and it's a problem. And how does the staff know? How does the staff always let people know? They leak to the media. Right? There was that piece in CNN. There was the piece in Politico that let it out that the staff is irked, or that there are bottlenecks and indecision is plaguing the White House, and that some decisions have lingered for over a year. So I think it is an interesting new narrative and something we've got to watch closely.
Tevi, I'm going to be very interested because you're very fair. As you reflect on older people that you have known and what happens to their decision-making skills, and I do not believe the president is incompetent. I do think he's infirm, but infirm in the way any 80-year-old is infirm. Slow, not very eager to change positions, not very flexible or fluid, as Arthur Brooks would say in the intake of new information, and sometimes bitterly stubborn about things. What percentage of this is Biden aging? And not, you know, all that nonsense about dementia. He's got dementia, but he's infirm. What extent of the dithering goes with being old and confronted with new facts?
I think a portion, but I think another portion is being the president, right, invested with these huge powers and these huge responsibilities. And what I say in the article is that he had a couple of early decisions that didn't work out so well for him. The decision that, hey, let's go big and be LBJ or FDR with a really narrow majority, how things went in Afghanistan. I mean, he was decisive on the Afghanistan thing. I disagreed with how he went, but he's quite decisive there. And I think the power of the office and the import and the long-term historical resonance of these decisions, I think, may be challenging.
Coming up, the voters that put Trump in office.
Hey, guys, how are you guys with her?
No hands.
How are you guys with Trump?
150 hands.
Brett Baer, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy enters our 25th anniversary year, we've remained committed to a single truth of world history, that ideas have consequences. To understand these ideas and their impact on today's politics, and to test them quantitatively, requires the unique curriculum we offer on our Malibu, California campus. Apply now for fall classes at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. To say that President Trump was a great disruptor on the American political landscape would be putting it mildly. From his candidacy to his securing of the nomination to his presidency, he showed a willingness, in the language of our next guest, to turn over some tables. It's no secret that some on the right didn't take well to President Trump, but along the way, a number of key voices took to diminishing his supporters.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
Among those who spoke negatively of Trump's base was Bret Stephens of the New York Times. He came out with a column that was sort of a mea culpa. The title was, "I Was Wrong About Trump Voters." That column was a catalyst for my conversation with Brett Baer of Fox News. You're a product of Catholic schools, and you're a very good golfer. I point this out because if you go to Catholic schools and you play golf on public courses at all, you run into the great American middle class. That is just inevitable. There is a column in the New York Times by Brett Stevens on what he was wrong, most wrong about, Trump voters. And I believe it's because Manhattan Beltway media elites don't have any connection with America's middle class. And I mean, everybody on every public course everywhere, 9 out of 10 are going to come from America's great middle class. Do you agree with my proposition?
I agree.
Brett says, I just didn't get Trump voters. It's the second admission against interest. The first was by Peggy Noonan. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it yet, but I think it's a very important admission by Brett about what America media elite have gotten wrong about Trump voters. Have you read it yet?
Yeah, Brett? I read it. I did.
What did you think about it?
Well, I think he's right. I think there was a lot of folks who missed all of that. And as it was happening in 2016, there was just a discounting of a whole kind of section of the population. And so no one really got it, and no one really got the polls right. They were way off. And I'm not sure they're right now. I think that there is still built in this missing section of the population that either doesn't answer the phone, doesn't tell pollsters exactly what they feel, and really is untapped as far as knowing exactly where they stand.
You and I have talked about this before, and I hate to bring up, I work for the Washington Post, I hate to bring this up, but the worst poll in 2020 was the ABC Washington Post poll less than a week before the election in Wisconsin that said President Biden was ahead by 17 points over President Trump. He won by 0.6 points, a little over 20,000 votes. And I believe that was a significant and distorting event. It certainly weighed on my understanding of what was going to happen. I'm sure it weighed on voters. More importantly, though, if you'd never, ever mix it up with, play golf with, caddy for, go to school with kids from the great American middle class, you're not going to understand their margin. And by margin, I mean, do they have any resiliency? And I'm about to interview Nina Totenberg about her wonderful book, Dinners with the Ruth. I mean, it's absolutely charming.
You do?
And she's a Beltway person. And they're different from folks. And the reason I referenced 11 trips to Afghanistan, 13 to Iraq, you spent a lot of time with sweaty soldiers in dangerous places, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they tell you how they feel. And listen, I'll tell you another story. I'm covering the convention in Philadelphia for 2016, Hillary Clinton getting the nomination. Fox is not on the inside of the auditorium, shockingly. We are outside, set up on a tent, but we have these studios, and the tent is set up by all of these union guys. And the union guys are wearing purple T-shirts with "I'm with her" on the back. And I walk out of the tent after a show, and this guy comes up to me and says, hey, Brett, hey, listen, come here. And I go over and say, hey, listen, I watch the show all the time, but I just want you to know I'm not with her. And I said, oh, what's that? And he points to his back. He says, I'm not with her, okay? And I said, okay. And I said, are there a lot of you like that? And he's like, come on. And he walked with him, and we walk about, I don't know, 200 yards to the lunch area. There's about 150 guys, all of them with purple T-shirts. I'm with her on the back. And he stands on a table, and he goes, hey, guys, how are you guys with her? No hands. How are you guys with Trump? 150 hands. And I said, that's amazing. You know, can I tell that story? Can you come on camera? He said, no, I can't do that.
I like my job.
Yeah, you know, Brett, he wants his job. But that's exactly the answer that I think you're talking about here. And I think it's still a phenomenon.
It's a big deal. Last week, I was in Ohio visiting my brother. And the guy across the street who's got a Trump flag, and the guy next door to my brother is not a Trump voter, but the guy across the street, here's I'm in town, comes out with ultra MAGA red T-shirt, says, hey, I hear you're here. And I said, you know, you don't have to wear these. I want you to see I'm ultra MAGA. And my brother had already told me it was ultra MAGA. And I got my ear bent by this guy. Now, this is Trumbull County, which is deep blue until Trump comes along. I mean, it voted for every Democrat except what they voted for Nixon in 72 in the landslide. But they're a Democrat county full of steel workers and automobile union, UAW, USW, United Electricians. And they haven't changed their mind, Brett, but media's elites, in it's more about Manhattan and Washington than it is about anything else. And if you haven't got any lines in, and I just wonder if Brett understands that he hadn't got any lines in. I just don't know. Of all the people that you have on the panel, and you have the best panel in America, you bring in about 25 different people show up on the panel over the course of a month. I think a lot of them have connections to this great middle class. And I think that's what distinguishes it. Is American media pushing off and saying, we'll see you later, we're going to stick with our own? Because it seems to me, except for Fox and your show, they're basically waving goodbye to middle America.
Yeah, I agree with you. Listen, before 2016, I traveled around swing states. I took 36 Ubers in my travels. At the end of the ride, I'd say, hey, listen, if you feel comfortable, can you tell me how you're going to vote? And 34 out of 36 said they were voting for Trump. And I said, why is that? And they said, well, you know, both sides suck. And he's going to kick the table over and do something different. And those people just were not in the polls. And when election night came and I had the call and I said, that means that Donald J. Trump will be the 45th president of the United States, I remembered those 36 Uber drivers. And I thought, man, we've got to be better at identifying who they are.
They showed up. They showed up and they're going to show up again. I tell people right now, I'm a bad predictor. In fact, on your show on Tuesday night, I was wrong about Maryland. I didn't pay any attention. I thought Kelly Schultz was going to win and Dan Cox won. And I was wrong that the CHIPS bill would be $75 billion. It turned out to be $250 billion. I talked to Cotton about it last hour, and now it's a bill I wouldn't support. But I'm not wrong about the folks in Warren, Ohio. I talked to them. And they're still for Trump, Brett Baer. And they still don't have anyone talking about them and their concerns. More importantly, why? Without scorn and contempt. And I don't know if that's going to change in media except on Fox between now and Election Day.
I agree with you. I will say the caveat is that there is a little air that has come out of the balloon, even in that population. And maybe not much, but some. And the January 6th committee, as much as people discount it, does have some impact around the edges, I think, with independents. Maybe not this what we're talking about exactly, but it seems like there is a hunger for another alternative, at least a little bit.
Oh, I agree with that. If that alternative will turn over the table.
Right. Exactly.
Because I don't,
they're kicking off the table.
Coming up, the American military is falling short of their recruitment targets.
And I don't know what the military is going to do. It's a national crisis.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. It's a look at today's most compelling stories and provides responses from key conservatives in media and politics. Over a 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I am a proud supporter of the U.S. military. I did not serve myself, but I married into a Marine Corps family, a family with a long line of distinguished service to our country. I have a son, son-in-law, and nephew on active duty. I also have a very strong conviction that our nation needs to retain strategic and tactical advantage over our key adversaries in the world today, Russia, Iran, and most importantly, China. That's why it's so important that we are falling woefully short in our recruitment goals. Victor Davis Hanson wrote on it this past week. He joined my colleague Eric Metaxas.
So the Reagan Foundation runs a poll on attitudes toward the military, and only 45% of the American public has confidence, great confidence in the U.S. military. That's a radical drop from the last time they did it in 2018. And then this year, Eric, only 40% of the recruitment targets have been met. So they're down 60%. And most importantly, somewhere between 40 to 50% of all recruits have parents and grandparents that were in the Vietnam War or the Gulf Wars or military service in general. But now that figure is just crashed down to about 12%. So what I'm trying to get at is we have had a massive reluctance of the traditional families to go into the military. And who are those people? Well, we don't like to talk about it, but since the left started talking about proportional representation at all areas of military service, white males have died between 74 and 77% of all combat deaths in Afghanistan and Iraq. And that's about double their numbers in the general demographic. And those are the people who have been targeted by, as you remember, Secretary Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chief Milley in these congressional testimonies that they were going to ferret out what they called white rage and white supremacist. And they were referencing Professor Kinney's work, but they gave us no data. By that, I mean, when they testified before Congress, they didn't say, here is data that shows that the white male is prone to more racial chauvinism or discrimination or supremacy than his Latino or Asian or black counterpart. They just threw it out there in the hysteria following both the George Floyd riots and then the January 6th. So I said the crisis, they don't have enough people. And so I said there has to be three reasons. And one, of course, was humiliation in Afghanistan. And Milley and Austin, even though they had been told by their mid-ranking officers, if they pull everyone out, it would be a disaster. We did so. It was a disaster. We abandoned a $1 billion embassy, a $300 million retrofitted airbase, $60 to $80 billion, which is twice what we've given Ukraine in military hardware and infrastructure. The second thing that really caused this fall off in recruitment was when you target the people who are traditionally enrolling, and not just enrolling in the military, they're enrolling for the most dangerous type of service, and you perpetuate that agenda on hot-button issues. So you say, we're going to pay for transgender sexual reassignment. If there's going to be a repeal of Roe versus Wade, we'll talk to senators maybe about having army bases used as abortions. So they are on the forefront of social justice at the very time their military efficacy around the world and with the American public is dubious. And then finally, we have a crisis in leadership. When General Milley said that he had contacted his counterpart in the People's Liberation Army because he felt, according to, I guess I could call him Dr. Milley's self-diagnosis, that Donald Trump was on hinge, and then it was his duty to tip off the Chinese.
Yeah.
And then in addition, he called in all of the theater commanders and said, should you get an order for Donald Trump about a strategic strike, you go through me. When he's an advisory, by statute, he cannot interrupt the chain of command. So in other words, that was almost an abortion of the chain of command on his part. And when you compound that with the retired military, Colonel Nagel and another wrote an op-ed saying that if Donald Trump won the 2020 election, he might stage a coup. Milley should intervene if that were to happen. We had 9 or 10 retired officers who called their commander-in-chief the following, a Nazi, Mussolini, comparable to Auschwitz jailers. A liar, Admiral McRaven, said he should be removed sooner than later. Those are all violations of Article 88 of the Uniform Court of Military Justice that say that you should not disparage the commander-in-chief if you're an officer, active or retired. And I'll just finish by saying half of us either supported or voted, they say, and I've talked to them, Donald Trump, and the U.S. military says, therefore, we are suspect. And yet we're the ones that die when you have these optional wars in the Middle East, and we're not going to do it anymore, especially when you go and hound us. And I don't know what the military is going to do. It's a national crisis, given what's on the horizon abroad and the dangers that are accruing in this presidency. And I don't know how you restore confidence to that particular demographic that has died inordinately to protect this country.
Coming up, a look inside our intelligence community.
There is absolutely a politicization of the intelligence community writ large, but most especially at the top.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The problem that our military has with its recruitment is certainly driven in part by changes in the culture at large. But the more acute and more obvious factors are related to what is going on inside the various branches of our military. The dynamics we see in the military have some parallels in our intelligence community as well. Brian Dean Wright was of those on the inside. He's a former CIA agent and now host of the President's Daily Brief podcast. He joined my colleague Sebastian Gorka.
How is it, as somebody who's been in the intelligence community, who's worked with the IC and our military, that we have, for example, a chairman of the Joint Chiefs who in February says Kiev could fall in 72 hours and then 4 weeks later testifies in the Senate that this could last for years, if not decades? How does that happen to the most senior military person in the United States?
Well, that guy. So a couple of things. First, there is an intelligence failure here. And I think what you saw was most of the people in the intel community or the IC said that Kyiv or Kiev was going to fall virtually immediately. But there was one group, the State Department's intel groups called INR. They actually didn't think it was going to happen very quickly. They thought the Ukrainians would actually fight and fight well. And they did that because they were actually on the ground interviewing people, conducting polls, and they captured what's called the will to fight. The Ukrainians wanted to stand up for their homeland, and that's what the IC completely missed. So I think that unfortunately, guys like Milley and others, they're not really paying attention to the intel on the ground, and they're not understanding the complexity of what they're reading, because in Milley's case, he's just not a smart man. I'll just say it. He's not, right?
No.
So we had an intel failure in the run-up to the war in Ukraine, without a doubt.
Yeah. Not a smart man. Also a political animal, and as far as I'm concerned, a disgrace to the uniform he wears. A man who says he doesn't know what critical race theory is, but he's happy it's being taught at West Point. A man who says, I'm white and I want to understand white rage. He probably should understand communist rage a little bit more, or Chinese Central Committee rage or Kremlin rage a little bit more. A man who should not be in that position after the disastrous surrender of Afghanistan and the absolute intelligence failure when it came to Ukraine. All right, so we've talked about the intelligence failure and the lack of intellectual strength of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, putting it as diplomatically as I can. Let's talk about something a little bit even more problematic. Talk to us about your concerns for the politicization of the intelligence community and federal law enforcement, and what you think as a former practitioner could and should be done about it.
So this is a remarkably bad problem. I share your concern. I know my experience is perhaps different, but we have come to the same conclusion that there is absolutely a politicization of the intelligence community writ large, but most especially at the top. And then, of course, at the middle and lower tiers, you have the woke stuff, which is degrading the IC and its capabilities as well. This politicization piece really comes down to, there was an old spy named Aldrich Ames. He was a CIA officer who worked for the Russians, unfortunately, the Soviets at the time. And he was asked why he did it. And he said, I do it because I know what's best for the nation's security, the national security, and I'm going to act on that. Right. So it's this idea that people in power who are basically unelected and unaccountable to anyone, they think that they know what's best for you, for I, for the American people. And it's alive and well. We've seen it. James Comey leaked classified information to The New York Times to help bring down Donald Trump, to bring about the appointment of Bob Mueller. So we know that this isn't some sort of conspiracy. You've lived it, friend. But we know in the public sphere that it's real. So the question is, what do we do to stop it? What do we do to flesh that out? And I think the first thing you do is you just make it smaller, getting rid of some of the individuals at all levels, frankly, because it's just bloated. And so that'll help, I think, address part of the problem. And then I think you start engaging in episodic investigations. Right now, that there's something called a rolling investigation. You don't ever just get a clearance and you're done. So I think that if you juice that process up a bit and you start looking at people's engagement with media, for instance, or you start asking them questions about their illegal activities. I think there are creative ways that you can do that on the inside. But the bottom line is I think you start talking about it more than anything. And frankly, you have leadership at the CIA who says it's a problem. And then you start getting rid of people once you go through that investigative process. And you just start getting rid of a lot more people because the IC is just too darn big.
What about the legacy clearances? When you have, you know, politicals like Brennan and like Comey who go on national television to trash a duly elected president and they still have access to the TSSCI clearances, is that also something we have to review, Brian?
Oh, that we don't have to review it. We just do it. That's low-hanging fruit. We also look at the guys and the gals who join some of these large, you know, military-industrial complex companies, the Raytheons and so forth. We start looking at those folks and saying either, A, we have a problem here in terms of undue influence, or we actually just ban some of the folks who work for the U.S. government joining those groups for, say, 10 or 20 years after the fact, which basically strangles, you know, that connection, that pipeline between the Pentagon or the IC and some of these big companies that profit off of war or conflict. So I think that there are ways that we can tighten up what's happening in this country around the politicization and the empowerment, the unlawful empowerment of some of our most powerful intelligence officials.
When it comes to this idea of the politicization of the IC, what effect does it have when a former DCI, a former director of Central Intelligence, like Brennan, goes on national television in America with all his clearances intact and says the current incumbent of the White House is treasonous? What effect does that have on potential walk-ins or people in hard-target countries like Iran or Russia who want to help us, and then they see this clip from CNN? The current president is working for Putin? How much damage can that one interview do to America's national interests?
He knew that. And I'll tell you, without going into details, there was an effect. So the bottom line is John Brennan weakened this country because of his hatred for Donald Trump. And that's established. Now, moving forward, what does that also do for the individuals working in the IC? It also means that they are incentivized to stand up when they decide, hey, I don't like the current president either. Yes. So what we're doing, two things. One, we are disincentivizing people from around the world coming to us to say, hey, I have information that you all need to know, right? Or I know of an attack that could happen in America, so I need to share that with you. Those people are going to, you know, avoid coming in from the cold.
Right.
And then the second piece, of course, is the individuals that we do have on board are going to get very frightened and scared, our assets and agents, and they might quit. That is to say, the people that we've recruited, they now are coming to people like me who meet with them once a month or once every 6 months or whatever it is. And they say, I don't think I want to be on board with you guys anymore, giving you secrets, because I think you guys are going through a real mess. I don't trust any of this. And that's happened too, by the way.
Coming up,
China watches this and salivates.
A few more minutes with Brian Dean Wright in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Georgine Rice. This week in the Christian Outlook, sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, President Biden hints at declaring a climate emergency.
This is an emergency, and I will look at it that way.
We'll look at what it means and what it says about the state of our nation.
The emergency here is that we're having a breakdown of representative government.
We'll look at an attack on another elected official, Congressman Lee Zeldin of New York.
The only reason why he got charged and arrested again was because I'm a member of Congress.
And we'll hear from the author of the book, Analog Church, with a helpful warning on our increasingly digital lives.
I found myself spiraling into the vortex of the comparison loop, and it began breeding contempt in me.
All this and more, be sure to join us and visit our website at christianoutlook.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. It would be one thing if we saw a left-wing agenda working itself out inside our military and intelligence community if our adversaries were weak and ineffectual. But that is not the case. China is increasing its military spending dramatically, catching the attention of all the smart ones watching. Some have called our new Cold War, Cold War 2.0. Let's pick up on Sebastian Gorka's conversation with Brian Dean Wright.
the wokeification of the military when you see the appalling figures for not only retention but inability to recruit the requisite numbers? How concerned does that leave you? Not just in terms of politicization, but in fact, yeah, you know, not getting enough people to put the uniform on.
So big deal. We're actually talking about the folks in the military are talking about actually shrinking the size of the force because we don't have enough people joining. Meanwhile, we're throwing people out because they wouldn't take a vaccine.
Yeah.
So it's just a complete wild disconnect right now. And it really has to do with leadership. Both Milley and Biden, both absolutely failed leaders. But I also think that this woke stuff is playing into it, too. Right. So if you were told from knee high that America is bad, that there's the patriarchy and really ultimately America is irredeemable because of all the white people, well, what are you really, are you going to stand up and fight for this country? Are you going to stand up and die for it? I don't think so. You're certainly going to, you know, scratch your head and think about it once or twice before you sign on the dotted line to join the military. So there are very real effects to this sort of leftist revolution that we're seeing in this country. And it means an inability not to just defend ourselves, which is most important, but if we have friends or allies abroad that need us to step in moments of tyranny, we're not going to be able to do it, not as well as we otherwise would have. So there are real implications for this Milley Biden wokeization baloney that's happening.
And of course, our enemies are following it very, very closely and are very happy about it.
Amen. Are you kidding me? China watches this and salivates because they know that someday there is almost certainly going to be not just the covert fight that's currently happening, but potentially an overt fight as well, the conventional war. And they are weakening us every day of every year. And this kind of stuff only feeds into their joy for what could come.
Allegedly, it was Trotsky that said it. You may not be interested in war, but war is definitely interested in you. All right, last question or two for you. What is your message to those who in the last 6 years who just say, okay, I'm just going to keep my head down, whether I'm in the CIA, whether I'm a school teacher, and I'm going to try and avoid getting in trouble? Is that the American way, Brian?
So it will come for you, as you just said earlier, my friend. This conflict isn't going away, and so we have to stand up and we have to fight it. So the question for a lot of people is, you know, how? If people start running for county-level position, that's where a lot of power in this country resides. And you can control a lot of this leftist woke baloney locally. So take joy, you know, in knowing that you can do things on the local level that have a huge, huge difference in how this country moves forward.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Town Hall Review is part of the Salem Podcast Network. If you haven't signed up for our podcast yet, please do so today. Why not give us a nice 5-star review? Subscribe. Go to townhallreview.com. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producers David Pashon, Michael Cook, Tim Gantner, Adam Ramsey, Jacob Orduña, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thank you once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.